This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We will talk with Karen Carter Peterson, the chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party, state senator, who is trying to re-energize the Democratic Party, which still has a plurality of voters in Louisiana. Almost 48% of the voters in the state are Democratic, but only one statewide elected official is a Democrat, and that's U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu, who's up for re-election. We'll talk about it with Senator Peterson. Also on the show, Judy Benitez, longtime activist for those who have been victims of sexual assault and domestic violence. She has an update on what's going on in Louisiana in that regard. And today is the 80th birthday of one of the basketball greats of all time, who was born in this state in 1934 on this date, Bill Russell. We'll talk about it. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is Karen Carter Peterson, Democratic member of the Louisiana Senate and chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party. Good morning, Senator Peterson.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, good morning. Good to talk with you. And this is a busy time for you as a state lawmaker. You're revving up for the session to begin the 10th of March, and also for the Democratic Party, a year in which the lone statewide elected official representing the Democrats, Mary Landrieu, is up for re-election. How is that race looking?
Oh, man, it looks really good, as it's looked for the last three races for Senator Landrieu, and for so many reasons. I think Senator Landrieu is going to be successful, but today's a big day for her. It's predicted that she will be chair of the Energy Committee after the caucus meets today up in Washington, and that's really important for Louisiana and certainly the number of jobs that come as a result of that post and the kind of influence that she had the last time that we had a chairman from Louisiana in that position. Of course, it was another strong Democrat in Senator Bennett Johnston, and so we're looking forward to that. But for the last three elections, this will be the fourth time that, and we're going to do the same thing. We're going to win. Senator Landrieu has made the case based on her record because she stands up for Louisiana families. And so it's the number one priority of the Louisiana Democratic Party. And as we talked about at our meeting on Saturday, we gave an early endorsement to Senator Landrieu along with Congressman Richmond. And we are powered up and ready to win both of those elections and maybe a couple more.
Democrats, according to the numbers, have 48% of the voters in the state, about 1.4 million out of 2.9 million, and yet Senator Landrieu is the only statewide elected Democrat. What can you do to change the inertia? As you know, a decade ago, Democrats controlled a vast majority of the statewide seats, but it's changed dramatically in the last 10 years.
Sure. And look, that's a good point, Jim, and a fair point. The only thing we have on the table with respect to elections this year are the federal elections. And so in the fall, I shouldn't say that because there are other local elections, of course. And let me first start with there are six sitting mayors of major cities in Louisiana, which I say is a great bench to have, whether you look at Alexandria with Jacques Roy, Baton Rouge with Kip Holden, Cedric Glover in Shreveport, Danny Mayo in Monroe, Randy Roach in Lake Charles, and Mitch Landrieu in New Orleans. All six of those guys are doing phenomenal jobs as CEOs and executives. And so, you know, we just had Mayor Landrieu reelected with significant numbers, a strong presence. There are other races that are coming up in the fall, and we expect to have Democrats run strong there. But this year, the number one priority statewide, as you mentioned, is Senator Landrieu. And so she's won three times prior, and we expect a big win in the fall because she stands up for Louisiana families. And at the end of the day, to compare her record to Congressman Cassidy's record is a no-brainer for Louisiana families. And the kind of strength that she's brought, not only on as a result of her becoming the chair of the Energy Committee, but if you look at flood insurance and the FAIR Act, if you look at, you know, in protecting our coast and restoring our coast, she's on the front line to do that. And so we're excited about that, and that is going to be the first step in the momentum building process of the Louisiana Democratic Party. And then we can get to 2015 where we're going to win again, building off of that momentum from this year. And then in 2016, we're going to have a Democratic nominee for president. And so there's some clearly defined goals, and we feel like we have certainly powered up the party with technological advances and use of we've always been grassroots.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. For Karen Carter Peterson, State Senator and Democratic Party Chairman for the state of Louisiana. Elwood in Atlanta, you're on the air with Senator Peterson. Hi, Elwood.
Good morning. Ms. Peterson, CNN just quoted a close friend and supporter and colleague of David Vitter in the U.S. Senate, Rand Paul, saying, President Clinton is a sexual predator and women shouldn't vote for him, even though President Clinton is not running for office anytime soon. But since David Vitter bought women's bodies the way you would buy meat in a supermarket, do you think that Rand Paul's own words should be used against Senator Vitter when he runs for governor, since evidently Vitter has no respect for women? And Ms. Carter, have you read a column at righthandthief.blogspot.com by David C. Bellinger, the May 22, 2010 column?
All right. What about David Vitter? Are his personal failings going to be an issue?
Look, I think that certainly as the Louisiana voters look at the candidates next year in 2015 for governor, everything's on the table. Certainly character is one of those issues. But even if you put that aside, which I'm not suggesting you do, the Washington-style politics of the senator and his repeated attempts to just say no to any progress certainly should not be brought down here to Louisiana in the governor's office. His failed policies are very similar to the policies that the current governor has. And I've not heard him say that, for example, he's for increasing the minimum wage. He's for expanding Medicaid. That helps Louisiana families. Nobody who's working 40 hours a week should have to rely on SNAP benefits in order to make ends meet and to feed their kids. And some of these positions that Senator Vitter has taken are going to just essentially give us the third term of Bobby Jindal. And I don't think that's in the best interest of our state. So voters are going to have to not only analyze and evaluate a person's character that's running for office, but also their record.
So if this is talked about, it will not be discussed by the Democratic Party as far as Senator Vitter's problems back in 2007?
Look, if we're going to talk about issues with Senator Vitter as it relates to women, I want to know why he's not championing the pay equity issue in Louisiana when women earn 67 cents on the dollar. Why is he not for that to change in Louisiana? Is he going to support that so that not only in the public sector, as we were successful in getting done last year, will he support the initiative to make sure that women who do the same job every day are paid equally? Show me how he's standing up for women, whether it's domestic violence prevention and issues or sexual abuse. Show me a record where he can say that he's strong on women. I suggest to you that it's void. He's void of that. And so, as I mentioned, character is something that the voter will have to make a decision on. And I'm suggesting that we are going to highlight his record or the lack thereof.
297-5633 is your number for Senator Karen Carter Peterson. David Vitter, the junior senator from Louisiana, has announced he will be a candidate for governor next year, and he'll have company, at least one Democrat in John Bel Edwards, and at least one Republican in Jay Darden. Based on what you just said about the senator, some might think he's a really bad fellow, but he's never lost an election in Louisiana. What does that say about the electorate in our state?
Well, you know, I don't think that the people in Louisiana and the electorate, as you referenced, are interested in having Bobby Jindal's third term, and that would be the equivalent of electing David Vitter as governor. If you want more of what we've had, for example, turning down federal money for the sake of political ambition, I didn't hear Senator Vitter talk about how Governor Jindal should accept money for rural broadband, should accept money for early education initiatives, should accept money for high-speed rail. In fact, there was silence on his side. He did not suggest that Louisiana should move forward and accept the federal tax dollars that we're sending to Washington. Why was he silent on those issues? To me, it is because his position and his policies are very much the same as Governor Jindal's, and we can't afford that. Let me get to higher education. Higher education, the governor just rolled out a plan for higher education. Essentially, he might as well have said to all of the parents, congratulations, parents and students, you get to pay more to go to school here. That's essentially what he did, because he's putting a cent tax on attending our universities. And I don't see Senator Vitter, and I don't suspect that a Governor Vitter would do anything differently.
All right, but Bobby Jindal has governed about the same way through his first two terms. There's been no big change in the second term. He ran for re-election 3 years ago, and he got 66% of the votes. Some would say, look, it'd be a good idea to adopt the same policies as a person who got two-thirds of the votes. The people of the state apparently embrace just what you're denouncing.
Well, let me say this. Two things are going to happen. First of all, I wasn't chair of the party when Bobby Jindal got elected governor for the second term, number one. Number two, we didn't have an infrastructure as we have not only at the Louisiana Democratic Party, but all across this state. Democrats are enthusiastic and engaged, and they are now ready to say no to anything close to what Governor Jindal has represented. And David Vitter is the equivalent of that. And so what you will see after Mary Landrieu wins re-election to the U.S. Senate in this state in the fall, you will see that momentum roll over into 2015, into the 2015 elections statewide. And it won't only be the governor's race. It will be other races as well. And we're going to have a strong message, and there's going to be a contrast between the Democratic nominee and David Vitter and Jay Darden.
Senator, I don't think anybody would disagree with you that if Mary Landrieu wins, the Democratic Party will be re-energized. It will have momentum, and it will be perhaps in a better place in 2015 than it was in 2011. But what happens if she loses?
Well, that's not really going to happen. I mean, I would not look. If you're taking a bet, anybody want to do a wager, I certainly would not bet against Mary Landrieu. And I'm just saying that we've had 3 for 3, and it's about to be 4 for 4 when it comes to in November. There are folks like President Brister in St. Tammany Parish who have fully embraced Mary Landrieu's candidacy and is supporting her. There are folks like Boise Bollinger. Now, these are who is in the shipbuilding industry down in the South, and really values how Senator Landrieu has stood up for Louisiana families, our coast, and our oil and gas industry.
Right, so but there are also people like Congressman Cassidy, who supported her in 3 elections, who obviously he won't be supporting her this time.
Yeah, well, it's unfortunate that Congressman Cassidy is in this race, and he was as you mentioned, he was a donor of Senator Landrieu, and I'm sure that, look, there's an opportunity for all of us to disagree on issues. But Congressman Cassidy, as Tony Perkins has said, can't beat Senator Landrieu. So Tony Perkins,
I don't know if he said that. I think he said he thought he might have a tough time, but did he actually say can't?
No, he did not say can't. He said that we need a stronger, I believe he said we would like to have a stronger candidate, because I will infer from that statement from Mr. Perkins that he does not believe that Congressman Cassidy can beat Senator Landrieu. And that is something that I agree with Tony Perkins. How about that?
Well, Tony Perkins ought to know he got 10% when he challenged Senator Landrieu back in 2002. And in that race, Congressman Cassidy was contributing his dollars. He and his lovely wife, Dr. Laura Cassidy, were contributing to Mary Loretta Landrieu Snelling's in her second bid for U.S. Senate. And this time around, the Cassidys are coming after Senator Landrieu. Can Senator Landrieu be unseated, or is Senator Peterson right in saying that it's a done deal, a fourth term for the soon-to-be chair of the Senate Energy Committee? We'll talk about it a bit more when we return. 297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757 outside the area, back in 90 seconds with Karen Carter Peterson. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. The Louisiana Democratic Party Chair, Karen Carter-Peterson, member of the Louisiana Senate from the 5th District, representing New Orleans, is with us. 297-5633 is your number outside the area, 877-217-5757, and inkstershow@wrkf.org if you'd like to reach us online. Stanley asked the question, Senator Peterson, about the congressional races this year, in particular in the 6th District. Do you anticipate that former Governor Edwards will get in the race?
You know, I think Governor Edwards has said, and some of the folks have been doing some polling in that race. Certainly after reapportionment, it was drawn by the Republicans in the legislature to be a really tough race for Democrats, and so that's the reality. I'm not ruling out a Democrat in that race, and certainly, you know, Governor Edwards can speak for himself with respect to his plans. But that's not known yet, and we are conferring with our partners at the DCCC, and time will tell whether we have a candidate in that race.
Will you have a candidate in all the congressional races this year? Will there be a Democrat on the ballot in every congressional district?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a little early for that declaration. We are in discussions with candidates for several of the districts. Some are more difficult than others. That's just a reality, and I think that it's important as a party that we focus on those opportunities where we can have some successes and grow. Look, progress doesn't happen overnight. It's decades of work, and certainly in the last year and a half that I've been chair, I've built a team and an infrastructure that we feel that, you know, we feel like we're powered up and we're ready to win and go after certain races. And I'm not going to suggest to you that we're going to be in every race. That's just unrealistic.
Paul in Opelousas. Paul, please be brief. You're on with Karen Carter-Peterson. Hi, Paul.
I'm doing good, Jim. Doing good. How are you, Ms. Peterson? You were last here a while ago. Very good
morning.
Experience. Just a question and a possibility. Everything is possible in Louisiana. Could Governor Jindal run for Senator Vitter's seat? Because I understand the senator does not have to give his seat up while he runs for governor. Could we have a Republican governor and a Republican senator? Thank you.
Yeah, and I think the question was, I'm going to make sure I heard Paul correctly.
I think he's Jindal's term ends in 2015. He's planning on running, or 2016, January. He's planning on running for president, not for U.S. Senate. So I think that's an unlikely prospect that Senator Vitter's successor would be Governor Jindal if the senator was elected governor. That's a thing, though, that is relevant, I think, is that if Senator Vitter were to win, he would be allowed to appoint his successor to the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, good thing that's not going to happen, though, Jim.
Okay, here are a few questions. Rick says the Bayou Corn sinkhole has exposed the administration's disregard for the people of our state. Says this neglectful behavior will somehow hurt Cassidy and Vitter. How will that hurt those two? And this was a Bobby Jindal
thing. Well, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, I think it was about August of last year when there was a lot, when this was occurring, it was at the height of the problems going on in the community in Assumption Parish, and we were screaming for help, and Governor Jindal was serving as the chair of the Republican Governors Association. He was traveling all across the country, stomping for Christie, stomping for McConnell in Virginia, just stomping for all of his Republican colleagues when Louisiana was hurting, and we were begging him to just go and visit this community. It took him months to respond to the needs of that community. And why do I mention that? Because you have the equivalent of Governor Jindal and his philosophy and approach to things when you look at Congressman Cassidy and you look at Senator Vitter. We don't want them anywhere in charge of anything more than where they are right now. It is harmful to the citizens of this state. It is callous in their disregard for humanity on many occasions. And that's just an example of it. I mean, how do you not put Louisiana families first and travel to campaign and yet can't travel to Assumption Parish? It's wrong.
Okay. If Bobby Jindal runs for president, the state will get a lot of attention. Do you think he has any shot of getting the Republican nomination for president?
I think that if Governor Jindal tried to run for president, the state would get a lot of attention. The attention would be from folks all across the country trying to elicit from the folks on the ground, well, how did you guys feel about him and his policies? And you'll look at failed policies and how many times the court had to drag him in while he was drug into court as a result of policies and not listening and not following the Constitution on the education front. They will look at the rest of the nation will have a flashlight on us to look at what's happening with respect to poverty. Look at equal pay for women. They'll look at some of these policies and say, well, why would we want this guy in the White House? Because it's not working. It's not working in Louisiana. We're still at the bottom of all of the good list and still at the top of the bad list. And so he hasn't had this phenomenal change. His rhetoric would suggest that, but the facts are not that. When you take $600 to $700 million during your term of office out of higher education, but yet you want Louisiana families to believe that you want every child to have an opportunity to a higher education, to be able to sustain themselves and their family? Well, no, it's nonsensical. It's all a farce. And so when the flashlight gets turned on, I think that he is going to have a really tough time, and he should think long and hard before he tries to pull that trigger.
Okay, the session starts on the 10th of March, not so far away. What do you think? Is it going to be a lively one?
Oh, without a doubt. They typically are, Jim. we've got at the top of the agenda is this minimum wage issue. You know, unfortunately, in Louisiana, we don't have a minimum wage standard and law. What Louisiana does is follow the federal standard. Some states have their own. And so at $7.25 an hour, that equates to about $300 a week. Louisiana families are people who are working. These are working families are pulling in $300 a week. Now, you and I both know that $300 a week in today's economy is not enough to be able to sustain yourself. So that's why you find a lot of the working poor having to utilize programs like SNAP in order to feed their families. This is just wrong, and it's an issue of fairness. And so we're going to be pushing very hard to increase the minimum wage and establish a standard here in Louisiana. The other thing we're going to do is we're going to go back and try to make sure that we take care of finish off the issue of equal pay for women. It is just wrong not to pay women for the exact same job, and they should have that opportunity to earn exactly what men do when they're doing the exact same job. No one has articulated why women should not be paid fairly in the private sector. So that's also going to be at the top of the agenda. Workforce development with the kinds of jobs that are going to be coming into our state as a result of this boom in natural gas, the oil and gas industry, it's going to be a significant issue when we're talking about technical and community colleges and making sure that they are helping our workers to be trained for the demand that exists today, along with Medicaid expansion. There was a shot last year to do it. Senator Nevers from Bogalusa is going to be leading the effort along with Representative Pat Smith. And I'm looking forward to working with them to champion that issue because there are 250,000 people that are in the Jindal gap, and they just can't get health insurance. And it's a result of the governor's, once again, political ambition coming before Louisiana families and putting politics before real policy to help people get health insurance. And we're talking about the Arkansas model. We're talking about a model where people will be on private insurance. This is not some long-term government program that, you know, the quick words and rhetoric that folks use will try to turn off part of the electorate to the support for supporting this. And it's just wrong.
A few questions I'm going to forward to you, and then we'll go back to the phones and our remaining moments with Senator Peterson. But are you supportive of the lawsuit that was filed by the levy board down in the New Orleans area against the oil and gas industry?
Yeah, as you know, the Louisiana Democratic Party on Saturday passed a resolution that was proffered by, in part, by Foster Campbell, Commissioner Foster Campbell from up north. And this is a resolution that offers support to folks having access to the judicial system. That is what that resolution represents, and I think that when there are contractual obligations, certainly there should be an opportunity for people to have those obligations enforced, and that's what the judicial system is about. And so this is about restoring our coast. We also passed a resolution that was supporting, of course, the FAIR Act so that we can get our fair share of revenues back from the federal government. So there are a myriad of issues, and at any point in time when there's an opportunity to promote the restoration of our coast and further protection of it, the Louisiana Democratic Party and Karen Carter-Peterson is going to be for it.
Randy and Zachary. Hi, Randy. You're on with Karen Carter-Peterson.
Ms. Peterson, my question to you is, during this upcoming campaign, will the Democratic Party put forth an effort to educate the voters about the horrible voting records of the Republican delegation to Congress, such as voting against the poor, the working poor, the middle class, no job bills, no immigration bill?
Obviously, Randy's in your camp.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Randy, for the softball. Appreciate that. And certainly we will be highlighting and showing the contrast between what we stand for and what the other side stands for. That is absolutely going to happen through voter education and grassroots initiatives.
All right. Here's a comment from John in New Roads. He says, in television footage on NBC 33, Governor Jindal is shown at the opening of the new digital media center at LSU. He's wearing at least 2 to 3 inch heels on a 2 inch platform sole. From the way the shoe is wearing, it appears he has lifts inside his shoes. Have you noticed a taller governor of late?
I can't say that I have. I have not seen that, and I've not noticed that.
You know, come to think of it, at the press club, he did look a little taller, and there'd be nothing wrong with a man wearing shoes that give him a little extra dimension.
Now, what really matters is what's coming out of his mouth and what kind of policies that he's enacted and he's pushing forth. I really don't care what size shoes.
Well, yeah, I'm with you on that, but it's been proved that usually the taller candidates in presidential races win, and that's what the governor is angling for. And Foster Campbell, I think, was the first person. He was on this show and said the governor was wearing, as he put it, elevator boots. So perhaps the governor is a little taller than he was when he was elected a few years ago for a second term as the state's leader. But you're right. There are more serious matters than that. Here's a bit of a devilish question from a listener saying, how can you attack Senator Vitters so heartily when both of you are proud graduates of the Tulane Law School, Senator Peterson?
that's a great question, and I am a very proud graduate of Tulane Law School. And when you say attacking, I am certainly highlighting the differences in philosophy and the differences in policy. I think most Louisianians, and I think I'm hopeful that Senator Vitter wants the same thing that I do. And what is that? That's an opportunity for every family to have a good quality public education, an opportunity to be able to afford health insurance, you know, some really simple things, be able to sustain your families and work hard, right? But there's different means to the end. And so while we have gone to the same school, you know, we may have, number one, a difference in the interpretation of the law, and that's what the courts are for. And we've seen that go through the process, whether it's at the federal level with the Affordable Care Act or if it's at the local level with these vouchers, right? And we've seen where the courts have come down on these issues. And I think that, you know, clearly Senator Vitter and I may have the same Tulane law degree, but we absolutely have differences in opinions on how to move Louisiana forward.
Now, we've talked about the Democratic Party and how the party has had difficulty winning statewide elections, and there are about 100,000 fewer Democrats in Louisiana now than there were 9 years ago. So where has the attrition come? Is it white Democrats? What's going on with the inner workings of the party?
Yeah, well, let me just say this, Jim, that, you know, I've been chair for about a year and a half now, and we've had significant success. Where we've come from, we've had 3 full-time employees when I came in. We've got 13 now. It's about building an infrastructure and making sure people know what you stand for. And the messaging is important, but it's also touching people, reaching out to our Democratic elected officials all across the state, making sure they're vested in what we're doing, and helping them, because those are my constituents and those are my clients, every Democrat, not only the elected, but every Democrat in this state. And so, you know, where we've been is one thing, but where we're going is another. We've got a strategic plan and we've got a vision, and that starts this year with reelecting Mary Landrieu. and we're going to have success, and we're going to grow as a party as a result of it. So I don't really focus too much on the past. You got to know your history, and trust me, I know.
Are you ready to go to war next year with Representative John Bel Edwards, the man from West Point, as the nominee, if you will, for governor of Louisiana from the Democratic Party?
Sure. I mean, John Bel has been a champion in the legislature and the leading the House Democratic Caucus on so many issues. Along with John Bel, we have other strong Democrats who are taking a serious look at the gubernatorial race. Everybody knows that. And I think in the next few months and maybe later this year, maybe not the next few months, later this year, you'll hear more from some of those folks that are thinking about it, and some of them may pull the trigger. Right? That's no secret to anyone. So the good thing is that any and all of our Democrats that are interested in serving in this state, the good thing is that there's a clear contrast between what Governor Jindal and what Senator Vitter represent and what our Democratic nominee will represent, and we're going to make that case.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on the air with Karen Carter-Peterson.
Good morning, Ms. Peterson, and let me just thank you for your courage and sticking to the Democratic guns, and also for supporting the working class and the middle class in the state. I just have to point out the Republicans are basically their record, kind of a shame for them to try to run on. You look at the record of what the vote is, and every time they vote against anything that's for the environment, they vote against.
All right.
Against,
well, do you have a question, Phil?
Yes, how can we get that out? And also, I would point out that is there going to be a voters registration drive?
All right. What about efforts to get a voter registration drive and to convey the message that you and Phil and Randy want the electorate to hear?
Sure, and thanks so much for that point. Let me mention, if I can just say, if folks are interested in making sure our message gets out, it's important for you to understand what that message is. And we have a wonderful comms team. We have at www.louisianademocrats.org. Folks who are interested in learning more about the party and getting emails and staying in touch with us and knowing what they can do in their local communities can go there. And once again, that's www.louisianademocrats.org. You can sign up for emails. We send them out regularly. And you can reach out to the party at 225-336-4155. That's 225-336-4155. And our team of 14, which we've got regional folks all across the state, can tell you how you can get engaged.
All right. So if I call that number that you just gave, am I going to get an answer? Let's say if I call at 8 o'clock tonight or 9 o'clock or some off hour during the weekend?
You're going to get an answer. You may get an answering machine at certain hours, certainly, Jim, but throughout business hours of the day, you're going to get an answer, and even if you leave a message, you will get a return phone call. But the easiest way to learn about what we're doing and stay engaged is to have our message point is to get online and sign up for the emails.
Well,
and,
thank you.
Yeah,
it's
sure,
a pleasure, Senator, and we hope to talk with you again. Very gracious to spend time with us today, and it's always nice to speak with you. Senator Karen Carter-Peterson on her way, and we'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It's 877-217-5757. Our guest is Judy Benitez. For many years, she served as executive director of the Louisiana Foundation Against Sexual Assault. Was there, about 20 years, right? 20 years. And you're wearing a new hat now.
Yes, for a year now, I've been the executive director of IRIS Domestic Violence Center here in the Capital Area.
So 1 year. And you're involved in many of the same issues that you've been immersed in for most of your career.
That's right. Domestic violence and sexual assault are very closely related issues. Unfortunately, a lot of people experience both in their lifetimes, and they share a lot of the same dynamics in terms of the root causes and the impact that they have on people. But it's a little bit different, but it's a closely related field.
Well, Judy has been a national person on this issue, providing consultation and reports for the National Institute of Justice, the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, among others. How does Louisiana compare with other states? We were last in many are first in many bad things and last in some good things, but this is a bad thing. Where do we stand?
Unfortunately, this is one of those bad things that we're close to the top on pretty consistently. The Violence Policy Center, which is a national think tank, releases a report every year on female homicides, and that is extracted from FBI homicide data. It isn't specific to domestic violence, but it is looking at when women are the victims of homicide, and the majority of those cases are, in fact, related to domestic violence. And we have since 1997, have been in the top 10. This year, I believe that we were at 11, but I don't think that necessarily indicates, you know, that we're really, that we've really figured out ways or have any good strategies around avoiding domestic violence homicide.
What is the catalyst? Why would we be 11th and some other state not be as afflicted with this problem as we are?
You know, there's really a lot of complex factors that go into that. It would be wonderful if we had an easy solution to a problem like domestic violence, but there is certainly a culture here that is different from some of the other states and the other parts of the country around firearms that definitely contributes to that in some parts. And also sort of a feeling that there's unfortunately still an attitude that domestic violence is a private matter between the individuals who are in the violent relationship and that other people who might see it happening should not get involved. And that's a very, very unfortunate aspect of this crime, because if people would get involved, it might prevent some of the really tragic outcomes.
What percentage of the domestic violence is men on women rather than men on men, or women on men, or women against,
you know,
women?
That's an interesting question. There certainly are cases in which men are victims of domestic violence, both at the hands of same-sex partners and at the hands of female partners, and there's same-sex violence within relationships between two women as well. The vast majority, though, are involving a female victim and a male offender. But our center here in the Baton Rouge area and serving the surrounding parishes does provide services to men and women, regardless of the nature of the relationship. So
Have a percentage? I would think most often it's men against women.
It is. I don't know the percentage off the top of my head, and I apologize for that, but it certainly is the vast majority, well over 90%, I would say.
You've studied what causes it, in addition to the raw numbers. What causes a man to beat up a woman?
Well, there are a million different excuses that people use, but what it comes down to is that he has a feeling of entitlement and that she is his property. And what it really boils down to is when people are violent against people that they say that they love, it's because they can get away with it. They have a perception that this is an okay thing for them to do and no one's going to stop them. And unfortunately, all too often, that actually is the case.
And why do women stay with men like this?
You know, there are so many different answers to that. It's really important to understand that women don't walk into a situation that's violent. Mm-hmm. It doesn't begin right away. It begins like any other kind of romantic relationship where there's courtship going on, there's romantic interest, and the two people are really interested in one another. And then over time, you start to see more controlling behavior, you know, really trying to dictate everything that the victim says or does. And that can lead, you know, sometimes it's faster, sometimes it takes years to develop, but that can lead to other kinds of control, such as violence. And by the time that happens, very often the victim has become isolated socially, financially. She may not, if the family has funds, she may not have access to them. There's often children involved. And the fact that this is a relationship that has been good at times, and people want to focus on that aspect of it and try to figure out a way to make it so that they can get back to having a positive relationship. So it gets very, very complicated when you've got issues of children and money and how is she going to support herself, how is she going to take care of the kids, and so on.
We're visiting with Judy Benitez for a few more minutes. She is the executive director, was the executive director of the Louisiana Foundation Against Sexual Assault for 20 years, and now is executive director at the IRIS Domestic Violence Center. She's a graduate of Syracuse and Southeastern Louisiana University, has been in these parts for some time. And I read in the paper every day, in the Baton Rouge paper, about people getting drunk driving arrests, and that's a terrible thing, and I commend the advocate for putting the names in the paper. But on the other hand, I usually don't read about somebody being arrested for domestic violence unless it's a case in which somebody is killed. And usually when somebody's killed, there are previous incidents. Shouldn't we be printing in the newspaper the list of domestic violence cases, when people get restraining orders, all of that? Would that be helpful?
You know, when an arrest is made, I think that there's some reporting on it, but again, these are very complex situations. And for example, it is not a requirement that a victim get a protective order. That is something that some domestic violence survivors choose to do, and others choose not to. And the reason that that is not required is that it will actually cause a decrease in violence from some offenders. However, receiving their copy of that restraining order in many cases, unfortunately, causes some violent men to escalate in intensity, and to really, at that point, he becomes extremely violent, and that can be a very dangerous time. So I would think that having it become more common knowledge, it is a matter of public record, but having it become more common knowledge that there is a restraining order against him, you know, it might have a deterrent effect on some people, but I think a lot of people it would cause an escalation in violence.
Mm-hmm. You do.
Yes, because the offender tries to impress upon the victim that any repercussions that he has to deal with, any accountability for his actions, is her fault because she told someone about it, because she reached out for help. So he is able to, unfortunately, in a large number of cases, he's able to convince her that he won't have to have he won't have to worry about losing his job, or he won't have to go to jail and miss time from work if she would just not, you know, report to anyone or call the police.
Well, in many cases, there's always a trade-off between exposure. People lose jobs over DWIs, too,
mm-hmm.
But sometimes the exposure causes them not to do it again.
Oh, and I'm not saying that domestic violence offenders don't deserve to have their behavior made public. I would be concerned about a possible escalation in violence in a case like that. But I think that we really need to focus as a society on not so much on why does the victim stay with a violent partner, but why does the offender feel like it's okay for him to beat and rape and financially and socially isolate his partner. And that's really the part that when we do have a tragic situation, people want to focus on what could the victim have done differently, or what could the criminal justice system have done better. Nobody really ever says anything about why does this guy think that it's okay to treat someone that he says he loves in this kind of manner.
Chris in Prairieville. Chris, you're on the air with Judy Benitez.
Good morning. I had a question. You keep referring to the violent partners as men, and I wanted to know how many instances of domestic violence are women that are violent towards men, and are those just not reported, or what is the history with that?
I'm really glad that you asked that question, because I don't know the percentages off the top of my head, and I do know that it's fewer cases in which the woman is the violent aggressor. However, it absolutely does happen. Men are victims of partner violence in some cases, and we at Iris Domestic Violence Center have had numerous requests for a support group for male survivors, and that is something that we are looking at starting within the next few weeks. So that's definitely an area where we're wanting to make sure that we're responsive to all survivors of domestic violence, male and female. However, the vast majority of cases do, and again, I apologize, I don't have the statistic with me, but they do involve a male offender and a female victim, which is why I use those pronouns.
Well,
because that's
and quite often, it's quite often, sometimes I'm sure it happens, but sometimes I'm sure it's just made up. The guy will say he hit the woman in self-defense, but a guy should never hit his female partner.
Well, and that is absolutely something that happens. You know, when someone is being beaten, that they will react in self-defense, and that's why it's become critically important and more common in the past, I would say, 10 years or so, for law enforcement officers to be trained in identifying which person involved in a situation is the primary aggressor. And there are definitely ways that they can learn how to do that, and I think that's becoming more and more common, which is fortunate, because having the victim, the person who is actually the victim, who was merely acting in self-defense, you know, regardless of gender, having them arrested and pressing charges against them is just a tactic that batterers use, and that helps to discredit her and you know, have her have the same kind of problems that anyone would have when they're arrested in terms of ramifications with their workplace or with their family or their community.
What is the percentage of women who at some point will be a victim of some kind of domestic situation?
This one I actually do have off the top of my head. It's the World Health Organization reports that 1 in 3 women worldwide will be a victim of relationship violence at some point in their lifetime. So it might be domestic violence, someone that they're married to, or it might be a dating violence situation.
All right. Well, your group, the new organization, or the organization that you're new to, the Iris Domestic Violence Center, it's having an event, and I know you wanted to convey this to our listening audience.
Yes, and Iris Domestic Violence Center is a new name for an organization that's been around for more than 35 years. We changed our name approximately 1 year ago. It had previously been known as the Capital Area Family Violence Intervention Center, which is a very long name, and so people would shorten it to the Battered Women's Program, and that, of course, was not necessarily accurate, because we do provide services to men and to children who are impacted by domestic violence, and not all relationship violence involves physical abuse, so battered was also kind of somewhat of a misnomer. So now we're Iris Domestic Violence Center, and that is a reference to the flower. It's kind of a metaphor for the women that we serve. And we are having our 19th annual Women Chef Show-Off on Thursday, March 20th at the Belle of Baton Rouge Casino.
March 20th. It'll be your 19th annual event under the new name, the first, I guess.
The second actually.
Okay, so for those who want to participate, what's the best way to find you or somebody affiliated with your center?
Well, they can call our Iris Domestic Violence Center at 225-389-3002 to find out about ticket information or purchasing a table or sponsorship. They can also look at our website, which is iriscenter.net, or on our Facebook page.
And if somebody has a particular problem, that's also a good place to go, iriscenter.net. Thank you, Judy Benitez. Good to see you.
Thank you so much.
And as we round out the hour on a somewhat more happy note, Bill Russell, the great basketball center for the Boston Celtics, born in Monroe, Louisiana on this date in 1934. He is 80 years old today, and one of his biggest fans lives right here in our community, is known primarily as a political consultant. But Roy Fletcher, you remember William Felton Russell in his prime. You're old enough to remember.
I can't tell you how much I love Bill Russell. Never knew him, but I just knew him from watching him on TV as a kid and growing up with him. And he was a transcendent kind of figure for me. He really was. He was special. And of course, his great wars with Wilt Chamberlain. It's just part of basketball lore. And to see those two guys go at each other, one was a scoring machine, and Russell did not have the physical gifts of Wilt Chamberlain. Few people did, but he always fought him, and his team almost seemed to win every time, in my opinion.
Well, Russell, as a player, won 11 championships in 13 years as an NBA.
And he was a player coach, too.
He was, and he won 2 NCAA championships as a player at the University of San Francisco. But Roy Fletcher, he wasn't as good as Chamberlain, let's face it.
Oh, he was all I know is, what are those statistics, 11 and 13? That's all I can say. That's all I can say. Yeah. I mean,
you're going by the record.
And I got to say this, in that 76er team that Wilt Chamberlain won, I think was one of the finest group of players ever to be assembled in basketball. I mean, it was just a great team. And the Celtics could figure out a way to beat them. And of course, it had all kind of players on both those teams. But the Celtics,
I bet you can name the starting five for the Celtics 50 years ago.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it was Bill Russell, and back then it would have been Bob Cousy and Frank Ramsey, and good Seth Sanders, I guess, had been playing. And then you had the Stones boys that came along, Casey and Sam.
John Havlicek?
John Havlicek came off the bench. John Havlicek was a sixth man. He was not a starter. Of course, his reputation is that he never stopped running. He would just run the entire time he was on the floor and just drive people crazy.
Well, happy birthday. We got to roll, Roy, but happy birthday to Bill Russell, born in Monroe, another great Louisiana athlete, as was Willis Reed and Robert Parrish and Elvin Hayes and Bob Pettit and Carl Malone, all born in the great state of Louisiana. Thank you, Roy.
Be good. Thanks, Jim.
Take care, and we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.